is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, currently featuring Emergence, International Women in the Arts, an exhibition of works by multiple artists. Also featuring a presentation and book signing by Linda Scott, author of Fresh Lipstick, on May 4th. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, a look at Islam through the eyes of an American Muslim woman, journalist Azra Nomani. She is the author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Nomani calls the book a tale of a journey into the sacred roots of Islam to try to discover the role of a Muslim woman in the modern global community. She says it is a manifesto of the rights of women based on the true faith of Islam, and she says it heralds a revolution in the Muslim world of the 21st century. With her infant son, mother, father, niece, and nephew, she set out on the Hajj, visiting the three holiest mosques in the Muslim world. And she says she returned to her home in Morgantown, West Virginia, with, in her words, an awakened understanding of the highest ideals of Islam for both women and men and for the community. She says it led her into a deep confrontation with tradition, power, and fear. Back home in Morgantown, she would struggle at her mosque for equal treatment of women. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WYLL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Azra Nomani is a former correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She covered the war in Afghanistan for Salon. She has also written articles for The Washington Post, New York Times, and Time magazine. Her book, Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam, is published by Harper San Francisco. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you're welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 9455. Asra Nomani, good afternoon. Welcome. And let me ask you here at the outset, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah, you are. Good afternoon to you, too.
Oh, my pleasure to talk with you. What a story you tell here.
I almost wish it was fiction, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, struggle is not easy, is it?
It's not, and it can take a lot out of you, but I have all of a sudden become a historian. I never paid attention to the great struggles of our past, but now I study them so intently because I see the common thread in challenging power and control through the ages, the cycle of intimidation and isolation that you face if you actually try to fight for justice, and it helps me so much.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to some basic questions here to get a little background. You were born in Bombay in 1965, and your parents left for the U.S. in 67, and then a couple of years later, you and your brother came to the United States. Tell us a little bit about your family and how it was that your parents came to the U.S. and then how the four of you settled in West Virginia.
Well, my mother and father both came from very traditional Muslim families in a little city called Azamgarh in India, right across from the Nepal border. In both their families, the women covered from head to toe in black. The women rarely worked, if ever, and I would say they really never worked outside of the home. The ancestry was always one of arranged marriages. My parents were arranged in their marriage. And yet, you know, they had this powerful spirit that guided them both over to America, and they were real pioneers in their own way. And so that was the spirit with which I was raised. My father had no problems with me playing baseball alongside my brother in New Jersey, and I had books with my best friend. My parents and I, we all moved to West Virginia when I was 10 years old. My father got a job at West Virginia University, and there, I lived the life as a good Muslim girl, but the world was my oyster. I could do anything I wanted to do, and my parents had me run track. And I never went to the church dances because a good Muslim girl didn't go to dances. But, you know, they let me realize my dreams, and that's how I started my path as a journalist.
Hmm. What was your experience of the mosque growing up?
Well, you know, my father and was a really important part of the start of our Muslim community in New Jersey. I would go to Sunday school regularly with my brother, and it was really beautiful. You know, at the beginning, it was inclusive. And what I've now come to recognize is that my life story is very much a window into the evolution of Islam in our current generation. It was really moderate as a little girl. And then as I started growing up, I started realizing and seeing more conservative Islam being expressed. When we moved to Morgantown, my father helped start Friday prayers and helped start the mosque. But the men in the community wouldn't allow women or girls to come to the mosque, so I never entered into it. And it was the domain of the men. It was just a men's club. My father couldn't take it on, and he didn't have the energy to fight it. So we just practiced at home, my mother and I, privately. And we were never part of the public space.
Yeah. And what's the situation today?
Well, you know, what that did to me was really put a barrier between myself and my religion. I couldn't penetrate this question of why is it that I didn't have full and equal access to the public space in my religion. Why did I feel less valuable than my brother? We would go to dinner parties, and I would end up with the women in little corners, in little apartments, while the men got the big, spacious lobbies. So for me, I ended up having a real crisis of faith that I think, you know, women in, let's be honest, a lot of faiths end up having, because you wonder how it is that there can be such inequity in the name of religion. And so for most of my life, I succeeded in the secular world and continued a private faith, but never really cared about the community. And then because of the same kind of events that happened on a public scale after 9/11, I cared again and have come to realize that conservatism has become very rigid in our communities so that, you know, when I came back to Morgantown, I confronted real inequities.
Yeah. And today, the situation within the mosque in your community, have you...
You know, what was really powerful for me, as you mentioned, is I went to the sacred mosque mm-hmm. of Islam, and in Mecca, I had no back door or no back corner where I had to sit. You know, it was just this one big spiritual mosh pit, men and women all together, shoulder to shoulder. I prayed beside my father, and excited about the faith, I came to the grand opening of our new mosque in Morgantown in fall 2003, and there an elder yelled at me and said, take the back door. And he was gesturing for me to take the back door to a back stairwell that led to a balcony where I was supposed to stare at a wall, deaf, dumb, and silent, you know, passing questions or thoughts to men on little slips of paper through children. And that's when my real confrontation with the faith crystallized, because I had to really answer for myself this deep question of whether I could be fully respected and expressed within Islam. And the beautiful answer that I found is that I can be, and that, you know, what that means, though, is that I got to challenge a lot of sexism that's put out there in the name of religion.
Yeah. You know, you note in the book that during the Prophet's time, there was no partition between men and women.
Right. And, you know, this is this little piece of information that seems so simple, but yet it's not widely circulated in our community. Instead, what everybody circulates is this idea that when a woman can't enter the mosque, or women have to stay in a separate area because the men are weak, and we're too sexy and tempting for them to enduring their prayers. And this is the mythology that we are forced to accept. It's only through knowledge that we can challenge it. So that little simple fact became a real eye-opener to me, so that it gave me the confidence to reject this assumption that they have for women in our mosques. And with that, I wrote about in the book, I walked in through the front door and into the main hall, and when they yelled and screamed at me, I knew that I had a God-given, you know, human right to sit there as a full citizen in our space.
Hmm. And are you still doing that today?
I am. You know, I go week after week, and the men are fighting a good fight. They want to banish me. They put me on trial at the mosque last July, about 9 months after I had first walked in through the front door and into the main hall. They had a petition signed, they say, by 35 men, said that I was a troublemaker, which might be true, but nonetheless, like in the spirit of civil disobedience, you know, believed firmly that it was for social just cause. And since July, I've sat on trial. I gave my responses to a list of allegations, but, you know, in this, it's just crazy. Like, sitting here in Morgantown, West Virginia, I don't get any of the rights that Muslims seek from the American government. After the Patriot Act, they just refused to tell me the names of my accusers or give me any transparency or due process. And the point, the greater point of all of this struggle is that, you know, in our Muslim world, we have to practice that which we seek. We have to practice the tolerance and the kindness and the justness that we want from the rest of the world for Muslims. And so that's why I fight. You know, I don't fight just for this little bit of carpet space or the front door. It's for to open up our communities in the highest principles of our religion.
Has your mother joined you? Have other women joined you?
My mother is so amazing. You know, she's a woman who never went into the mosque because she wasn't welcome. I, as her daughter, then took her into the mosque with me. I asked her if she would go, and for the first time in her life, over at 60 years old, she heard the Friday sermons, you know, that are preached week after week. she sat and saw what a preacher looked like. This is a complete realm that is inaccessible to most women, and she stands by me so firmly. So a few women have been supportive, but I'll be completely honest with you. I mean, this is not easy. Women have largely accepted these assumptions, and this is their social order. So they are some of the harshest critics of my action. But yet, it doesn't faze me because I know that it's right and it's just and it's Islamic. And so I know that, you know, it's as much of a challenge for a woman as it is a man to see change.
Yeah. Have you faced ostracism there in Morgantown?
Oh, we've had family friends that have told us never to come to dinner parties at their homes anymore. I got a lovely love letter, as I call them, from one of the professors at the university, a psychiatrist, who wrote to me to tell me that my father and my mother were invited for a special dinner during the month of Ramadan, the month of fasting. My brother and his wife were welcome, and he said, just to make it clear that there's no understanding, you are not welcome. So I did what I could do in terms of truth-telling, and I just reprinted his email in my book. And now use that to sort of show people, you know, what a low place we're at, you know, that we're just so lame in the way we deal with each other.
Mm. Are women in other communities here in the U.S. and other countries fighting the same fight you're fighting?
They are, and that's what's really kept me going, is through the power of the Internet, we've connected. Half a dozen women came to Morgantown and marched on the mosque, walked through the front door and into the main hall with me and my mother. We had the most amazing prayer in the middle of March that I helped to organize. I came through the process of my own education to realize that women have a right to be prayer leaders in our community and to lead men and women in prayer. This is something largely forbidden throughout the Muslim world because of judicial interpretations by the religious scholars. But we have this prayer on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. About 100 men and women were there, and there were so many tears and hugs shared because for the first time, so many people felt like there was a safe space in which they could practice this fully tolerant and inclusive Islam. And I get amazing emails from all over the world. And I got to tell you, not just from within the Muslim world, but from within so many faiths, for just about every couple letters I'm getting from Muslims, I'm getting a letter from a Catholic woman or man connecting to the struggle.
Hmm. Well, that brings me to my next question. I want you to tell us about the meeting, a chance meeting with the Dalai Lama in India in January 2001 that really set you on this course, first to make the Hajj, and then to come home to Morgantown and take the lessons of the pilgrimage that you learned back home to West Virginia. Tell us about the meeting with the Dalai Lama.
Well, I was on the banks of the Ganges River in India, an amazing place where millions of pilgrims had come for a Hindu pilgrimage. And I was literally lost as I was walking this large fairground of ashrams and tents, and I could see this brouhaha and all of these Tibetan Buddhist faces, and I inquired, and indeed the Dalai Lama was inside leading a prayer in solidarity with Hinduism. And at that time, in early 2001, India was defined, as it still is facing today, a real sectarianism of violence and intolerance between Hindus and Muslims. And I was sitting in the back of the press conference after his prayer, like a place where I oftentimes sat, and a man asked whether Islam was really a violent religion. And I realized that we were, you know, falling into that usual trap of demonizing religions, and something that was popular at the time in the government of India at the time they had a very Hindu fundamentalist religion ruling party. And I asked the Dalai Lama then, you know, how is it that our leaders can transcend their own egos in order to bring about peace and understanding between our faiths? And he giggled, and as he often does, and he said that, you know, we had to read each other's books, we had to talk to each other's scholars, and do each other's pilgrimages. And as I sat there, you know, scribbling his words, I realized that I had done the Hindu pilgrimage and the Buddhist pilgrimage, but I'd never done my own. And as much guidance as I'd gotten on the other paths, I really needed to find a sort of reconciliation within my own faith. And what he said then was that, you know, we really need to try to find some peace within the religion and with the religion into which we were born. And that's how, there on the banks of the Ganges, I decided that I would set off for my Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca.
Yeah. And now it's the year 2001. It's January, brand new year, and you're thinking, well, on my way back to the U.S.,
right?
I'll visit Mecca on the way home.
Yeah.
Not what it couldn't happen.
No.
Why not?
No, it's not just about doing pilgrimage. You end up having to, you get sucked into this vortex of rules that are define the pilgrimage through the Saudi government. Basically, one of the most oppressive interpretations of Islam perpetuated by the Saudis, and it requires, along with, you know, so many strict interpretations, that women have to travel into Saudi Arabia with their designated male chaperone. And it has to be your father, your husband, your son, or your brother. And so I couldn't just pull this off because my dad was in West Virginia. I was in India. We weren't even allowed to meet in Amman, Jordan somewhere and fly into Saudi Arabia together. We had to submit our passports into the same embassy. And so this is a kind of red tape that I think has kept so many people from actually going physically and literally and symbolically into the heart of our religion. So much garbage that's being perpetuated, it's such a turnoff. So many people that I know who don't even want to go because they mean going into this land that's so repulsive because of the way that they practice Islam, where women can't drive, women can't move, they are criminals if they, you know, have one strand of hair visible. And so this is really a window into this larger phenomena defining our Muslim world and the larger challenge we've got.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Azra Nomani, author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She's a journalist. She worked for the Wall Street Journal for a number of years. She covered the war in Afghanistan. She's written articles for the Washington Post, New York Times, and Time Magazine on Islam. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, from the meeting with the Dalai Lama in January of 2001 to January 2003, you've decided you will find a way to make the Hajj. And in January of 2003, though, at this point, your friend Daniel Pearl is kidnapped and murdered. Tell us about the days you spent with his wife, Marianne, trying to find him.
Yeah, you know, the world certainly changed after an encounter I had with the Dalai Lama, September 11th, happened. I ended up in Pakistan as a journalist, and one of my dear friends from the Wall Street Journal is Danny. He and I had worked together in the Washington Bureau of the Wall Street Journal, and we bonded over beach volleyball and both of our parents' quest that we married a good person from within our religions. He was a son of Jewish immigrants, and I had a daughter of Muslim immigrants. So we were both searching for that perfect person, right, that would make our parents happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came to Karachi, Pakistan, where I had gotten a house to finish writing a book, and he came with his wife, Marianne, who, you know, was everything but what he had been searching for when we were talking, but the love of his life. They stayed a day before Danny went then and left my house for an interview, trying to trace the handler for Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. Marianne and I waved him off, and there were beautiful parrots swooping through the sky, and we set out to make this great dinner that night with friends and kept waiting and waiting for Danny to come back. And as you and everyone else knows, you know, he never came back. He was kidnapped from the interview, bound and handcuffed, and that the days afterward were really a wake-up call to me as a Muslim. I saw the information coming in of how the men who planned Danny's kidnapping did so during the 5 times a day prayer, how they said that he was a Jew and thus find excuse to punish him and kill him. And the pictures that the world saw of him bound or dropped off in a mosque, you know, it was like a safe house for this intolerance. And I really did a lot of soul searching. I had to do a lot of soul searching about my faith. And I felt so pained that people were using this religion to which I was born as an excuse to murder an innocent and beautiful man. It was very painful.
Yeah. One of the questions you asked, you know, could you remain a Muslim? So how did you begin to, address that question?
Well, I then, you know, I was faced with this question on the most intimate level, because as we were searching for Danny's kidnappers and for Danny, I discovered that I was pregnant, boyfriend, a Muslim man that I'd fallen in love with in Pakistan while bombs had been dropping on Afghanistan. And, you know, I had to ask this question of myself in the most intimate of ways then, because according to the strictest interpretation of Islamic law, I was a criminal, unwed, and illegitimate. And so how did I start answering those questions? I came back home to America, and the embrace of my parents, who, you know, I talked earlier about embodied real conservative Islam as children, but, you know, as full adults are just beautiful and loving, and through their embrace and their example, I was able to see how it is that religion can be a vehicle for goodness, not destruction, because they went to the teachings of compassion and kindness and love, and that is what they had always taught me, you know, and I'd always rolled my eyes at my father when he would talk about, you know, being a good Muslim is to serve humanity. I thought it was just gibberish, right? But then I saw the ugliness in this world that's put out in the name of religion, and I realized that, you know, we're not living by these principles, that we're just distorting religion for power and control. And that's how I came to understand the truth. And my final resolution came when I brought and welcomed my son into this world. You know, through my family's love, I went through my pregnancy, even though my boyfriend had bailed on me because I was illegitimate now and unacceptable. And, man, my parents helped me, and this beautiful being came from the heavens into my hands, and I felt like I could make peace with if I took it back, if I reclaimed it. And that's what happened for me then. I set off on the pilgrimage to Mecca to physically and spiritually see if I could do this. And I went with my son and my loving family. And there I realized that we can reclaim the faith, but it's going to be damn hard, right? It's like a lot of dark forces against doing that. And that's how I came back to America from that pilgrimage, just committed. I knew that, you know, I couldn't call myself a Muslim and just watch this garbage happen.
Hmm. How was it that your parents decided they would make the Hajj and they would do it with you? How did all this come together? Your infant son, your mom, your dad, your niece, your nephew, you know, you're surrounded by this wonderful family now. But how was it that everybody decided that that's what they'd like to do?
Well, my dad, you know, wept at the idea of going. Like, he was so moved. And my mother, she was just like, I'm going to be the babysitter. You know, she just went begrudgingly because she is really, like a lot of people, disillusioned by the way religion is used, right, for political and personal gain and corruption. And so she was so funny. She just said, look, I'm going to just hang out in the Mecca Sheraton Hall with your baby. But sure enough, I mean, she came through the process with us and was such a great reality check. Throughout, my father would be weeping during some of the rituals, and my mother would just make sure that, like, everyone was alive, right? And it was a really great balance. And my niece and nephew got one of the coolest school field trips they could have asked for, including, you know, a taste test analysis of, like, the Kentucky Fried Chickens throughout the movie. Yeah.
That was so strange to read about this, you know, this very holy pilgrimage, and you're surrounded by the House of Donuts and Kentucky Fried Chicken.
And... I know. And I didn't even notice one of the photographs that I had. I didn't get this in the book, but not only was there the House of Donuts and the Kentucky Fried Chicken next to the sacred mosque of Mecca, but also a Dunkin' Donuts. So, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. This is globalization, universality.
One of the first things your father said in Saudi Arabia, he said, this is, and again, correct me if I'm not saying this correctly, Umma or Umma? U-M-M?
Umma, yeah, Umma. Right.
What does the word mean?
Umma means community, and it is a powerful word in our Muslim language. It is Arabic word, and it is used oftentimes to alienate, isolate, even intimidate, because what is oftentimes said is that, you know, we have to stay as one Ummah with a capital U. And so then there's pressure that to not break the silence, you know, of stuff that you see that's wrong. And what is the result of that? That you don't feel like you're part of a community. You know, you feel blocked off, you feel silence, you feel repressed. But what happened is when we got there, this Ummah was loving and kind and beautiful. It was one of people of all colors and languages. And so often I couldn't even understand the people next to me, but they were so universal in their language of love. You know, gently stroking my son's hair or exclaiming a prayer for him. And it was much like an experience for us that, like, Malcolm X had when he went on the pilgrimage to Mecca and realized the diversity in our community and the potential for love within the community. That's what it was like for me. I got to experience a really loving Ummah, not one that was, you know, judgmental and divisive. And that's what really inspired me.
Yeah. So there's all this diversity, yet at the same time, Mecca is closed to those who are not Muslim.
Yes, and I know that I won't make any friends within the, you know, puritanical sect, but I really believe we have to open the doors of Mecca and Medina, the second holiest city, to people who are not Muslim. I learned so much languages of other faiths, I feel like we could do such a great service to Islam if we opened our community, starting with our holiest cities, to people of other faiths. You know, we're so basically defined by fear. You know, we're so defined by the lowest common denominator in society. You know, they're so afraid of outsiders coming in. And this is the same fear in mosques, even in America. And we got to get over it. You know, we really have to be proud of the religion, be proud of what we are showing people, and not apologists, and really practice a really inclusive religion. And so I just think it's really a tragedy. And I think it's also emblematic of the larger closed-door policy in too much of the Muslim world.
Before you went on the Hajj and afterwards, what did you think about a couple of big questions here? What it means to be a good Muslim, and what is good and evil?
Well, you know, when I had been growing up, I got a lot of the messages from the community of what it meant to be a good Muslim. You know, that you had to follow these particular rituals, and you, as a woman, for example, had to cover your hair with the veil. It was really Danny's murder and my son's birth and then this pilgrimage that told me what it meant to be a good Muslim. And to be a Muslim means to be good, I believe. It means to be good to others, to be good to yourself, to be good to your family. Such a no-brainer, but so sadly not realized in our communities. And I know this because when I came to the mosque, the men did not greet me, right? They yelled at me when I talked about my son conceived as he was conceived. I get all this hateful letters. And yet, you know, there's enough of the spirit of beautiful, loving people that I know that the fight is worth fighting. But that's what being a good Muslim means to me, is to be good. And it's so simple, and we got to practice it. 9/11 wouldn't happen then. If those folks think that, you know, they're good Muslims because they kill and murder, forget it. And so this is the truth of all of the religions, and it's such a simple point that we're not realizing in the world.
A few weeks ago, I think it was a few weeks ago, a couple weeks ago anyway, we had on the program Reza Aslan. And I don't know if you have been able to read his book yet, but a very interesting fellow. He's talking about some of the same things you're talking about, only not from quite such a personal point of view. Are you familiar with the book? I can't remember the title off the top of my head. There is no God but God.
I don't know the book, but I think I do know. I've read about his ideas. And it's this idea, right, about an inclusive, inclusive expression of Islam.
He also sees that this is a time when the conservative, beyond conservative, perhaps he would say radical,
right.
Islam. We're at a point of confrontation.
Yeah, we are. We're in a war. And I am not going to, you know, mince my words on that one. It's an ideological war. My weapon in this war is my pen. I will never take up arms. We are in a war like, you know, Martin Luther King and a civil rights struggle, like Gandhi and the anti-colonialists in India. The enemy, the opposition is very fierce. It's well-funded, it's well-financed, it's as strong as the KKK, the British Empire, you know, the apartheid regime of South Africa. And that's why I've become a historian, because if I didn't look back in history, I would give up, right? I would have no hope. But I do have hope because good must persevere. I have a little son. We must win for him and all the other children, and we have to figure out a way, and America must also figure out a way to stop supporting the empire that is sending so much of this hatred and intolerance into the Muslim world through Saudi Arabia. You know, Prince Abdullah is meeting with George Bush today. I looked at their agenda items, and, you know, Saudi Arabia's entry into the World Trade Organization is on the agenda. Oil prices. Nowhere on there is this real truth about how Saudi Arabia is so much behind this machinery of intolerance that goes out into the world, including my little mosque in Morgantown, West Virginia. You know, we heard sermons there preaching that strict puritanical Wahhabi interpretation of Islam. I wrote in the book about how I kept hearing these words over and over, and finally, through internet sleuthing tricks I learned in Karachi, traced them all back to sermons that had been downloaded from a website, you know, run out of Mecca, right? This heart of Islam, the birthplace of the religion. And yet it's still up there, it's still alive, it's slick, and this is just one example, you know, and it's much like the Goebbels machinery during Nazi Germany. I mean, I'm not over-exaggerating the impact of this in the world and what it is that, as, you know, Muslims we're facing, because what happens is this ideology becomes the weapon of intimidation against us, and so that's what people use to try to silence us.
Hmm. You've mentioned history a couple of times during our conversation here this afternoon, and before we run out of time, we only have a couple minutes left, I'd like you to talk about the great historical women figures in Islam.
Oh, well, my first and most remarkable inspiration comes from the woman that most of the world knows as Hagar and is known in Islam as Hajar. She was the concubine, some say, maybe a second wife to Abraham, and sent out into the desert by either Sarah or God's will. And there she was in Mecca with just her baby. And she did not throw herself at Abraham's feet, but rather strong in Mecca. And this, the symbolic strength for the name for my book, Standing Alone in Mecca, because she stood alone in Mecca and she became the symbolic mother of our religion, because from her strength came the tribes that into which the Prophet Muhammad was born. Hmm. And then at that time, in the 7th century, it was an amazing woman named Khadija, mm-hmm. who was the Prophet Muhammad's boss, 15 years older than him, and proposed marriage to him. And she was the one who encouraged him and helped him become a visionary and leader. And then his other wife, Aisha, was a theologian who rode on camelback. We had a Florence Nightingale in his mosque in Medina. And the stories are just so beautiful and yet forgotten, because we've basically been living our own Da Vinci Code. And now, because we care enough, we're decoding it.
Hmm. And have there been opportunities for you to talk about these issues with your community? I mean, is there any crack there in the...
There is. There really is. I just came back from Toronto, Canada, where I spoke to Muslims that are on the ground fighting the fight. I'm speaking in Seattle to another group of Muslims, and that was really so amazingly affirming for me. This isn't just, you know, me going to churches and synagogues and speaking to people trying to understand Islam better, which is in itself really valuable and important, but I'm also speaking and hearing back from Muslims who also want to benefit from this 2 years of research I've been able to do and get so much courage and strength as I do from them, because they still care enough, you know, they care enough to want to try to define Islam in the world. And what I've come up with is this idea that, you know, we're all, what we need to do is take the slam out of Islam, because that's what's turned us off. That's what turned so many people off from the religion. Mm-hmm. And there's so many kindred spirits with within the community. They're fighting hard. You know, they're mostly below the radar. But I hope through the book to highlight some of those people, because I really wanted to expose everyone to these really brave souls in our communities, scholars and community leaders who are challenging that orthodoxy.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Ezra,
thank you so much.
Ezra Nomani, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you for all your time.
Ezra Nomani is the author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. The book is published by Harper San Francisco. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, standing by with prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Mary, very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Monday afternoon, an interesting day in the trade. As you look at the numbers, especially from the grains floor, the corn up about 4 cents, wheat up 11.5. Not quite certain what happened there. There were some fairly large moves in the options market as some calls were put back into the market and some other things that happened, but we'll need to sort it out just a bit this afternoon with Kurt Kimmel during the closing market report. That comes up at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. We'll talk with Kurt about all that happened in the marketplace and about this 11.5 cent move in the May and the July futures up 11.25 in the wheat for today, and that pulled the rest of the grains floor and the oil seeds up too, for that matter, at the Chicago Board of Trade. It was led, by the way, out of the Minneapolis Grain Exchange as opposed to from the Chicago Board of Trade. So it would be a spring wheat rally that pushed everything up primarily. But we'll find out just exactly why that happened a bit later in the afternoon. In the May wheat futures for the day, 330, the high price. The low at 313, a settlement price at 320.75. They were up 11.5 cents on the day. The July futures had a high today of 340, low at 323.5. Their settlement at 330.5, up 11.25. And September contract, 347.5, the high. The low at 330.5, settled 337.5, up 11 cents for the day. And December futures, 357.5, the high. The low at 340.5, settlement price, 346.5, up 10.25 for the day. March contract now, 366, the high. The low at 356, settlement on that low at $3.56 a bushel. For the March wheat, and it was up 11 as well. From the corn pit, futures in the corn, May contract, 215 on the high. Low at 211.75, a settlement price there at $2.13. They were up 4 for the day. July futures were up 4.75 with a high of 223.75, a low at 220.25, and a settlement price at $2.22 for the July corn, up 4.75. September futures, 230.75 the high. Low at 227.5, and a settlement price there at 229. They were up 4.5 in the December futures now. 240 the high, the low at 236.75, settled 237.25, up 3.25 for the day. March corn futures, 246.75 the high, the low at 244. Settlement price there at 244.25, up 3.5 in the May contract. 250.25 the high, the low at 248.25, settled 249, up 4 cents for the day. And the oats now, 151 the high, the low at 147.75, settled at 149, down 1.75. And the July oats, 153.5 the high, low at 150, settlement price at 150.75. They were down 1 cent for the day. From the soy complex, nearby May beans, 649.5 the high, the low at 635, settled 635.25, down 2.25 in July futures, 656.75 high, low at 641, settlement price at 642, 1.5 higher for the day. August contract in the bean pit, 655 the high, low at $6.40, settled 641.25. They were up 2.5, and the September futures were up 3.25, 647 the high, the low at 634, settled 634.5. Now the November's, 642 the high, the low at 629, settled at 629.75, up 1.75. January soybeans, 643 the high, the low at 631, settled 631.25, 1.75 higher for the day in the January soybeans. From the rest of the soy complex, the products finished like this. The meal was higher, the oil was a bit lower. May bean meal finished the day at $200 even, that is, up $3.90 with a high at $204.70 and a low at $199. July bean oil, $204.70, the high for the day there as well. The low at $199.10 and the settlement price at $199.60, up $3.30 for the day. And May bean oil on the day like this, $23.18 the high, the low at $22.75, settlement price at $22.79, and they were down 2 cents for the day. July bean oil, $23.39, the high, the low at $22.90, settled $22.95, and they were up 2 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, it was a higher day today for cattle, while lean hogs and bellies, well, bellies finished up, May bellies finished up, but lean hogs mostly lower. April feeder cattle, 111.40, the high, 111 even, the low, the settlement 111.25, that up 77.5. May 108.70, the high, 107.50, the low, 108.65, the settlement, that up 175. August feeder cattle, 109.45, the high, 108.45, the low, 109.25, the settlement, that contract up 137.5. April live cattle, 93.75, the high, 92.80, the low, 93.75, the settlement, that up 172.5. June live cattle, 87.25, the high, 86.27.5, the low, the settlement, 87.12.5, that up 140. May lean hogs, 75.75, the high, 74.50, the low, 75.25, the settlement, that up 2.5. June, 76.40, the high, 74.40, the low, 75.15, the settlement, that down 75. July, 77.12.5, the high, 75.25, the low, the settlement, 75.77.5, that down 72.5. And August lean hog, 75.02.5, the high, 73.45, the low, the settlement, 74.12.5, down 50. May bellies, 83.37.5, the high, 80.80, the low, finishing at 81.50, up 15. The Dow up 75 points at 10,233. The NASDAQ up 13 at 1945. The S&P 500 up 8 points at 1160.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Marianne Martin from Eugene, Oregon sends this question with love. Dear Dr. Science, who is the smartest person in the whole world?
It's a toss-up between Willard Scott and Dr. Joyce Brothers. Willard has the most rigorously disciplined mind I've had the pleasure to observe. To watch the man in action, morning after morning, creating seamless transitions from unrelated item to item, all the while maintaining the illusion of effortless good cheer and mindless optimism, well, I can't say enough about the man. But then you have Dr. Brothers, the Hugh Downs of modern psychology. One part Ann Landers and three parts Wernher von Braun. You know what I'm trying to say here? Snoopy meets Linus Pauling. Am I making myself clear? Words fail me. I watch them both all the time. Enough said.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's.